Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 10, delivered on September 20, 2018. The title of this lecture is Ethics.
Today, ethics, the second of two special topics that are not covered adequately in the book. You see, the state of Illinois wants me to teach you ethics, which is hilarious as it is with Illinois, of course. It was the last year that the former president of the university, he was doing the graduation, and the faculty were all sitting, we were in our robes, and the students were waiting to get their diplomas. And the president of the university, Al Bowman, said, well, our keynote speaker today was going to be Rod Blagojevich, but actually, Blagojevich had just been sent to prison. Then he said, "So, but he is not available today." And the whole crowd just laughed. Well, Illinois is not an ethical state. But you see, here's the funny thing. When they think of ethics, they want me to teach you the law. The law says this, the law says that. Thou shalt not. That's their idea of ethics, is law. It is not. That has actually very little to do with ethics. Laws can be passed that pretend to impose ethical behaviors with punishments if you are not acting ethically, but that's just plain nonsense. They would prefer that I not step into the world of real ethics. And, of course, if you know me by now, when they tell me I'm not supposed to do something, that's when I can say, bite me. Ethics is touchy if you go in where I'm going to go. Because you can get into ethics is just a mealy-mouthed, careful way of dancing around right and wrong. It's a mealy-mouthed way of talking about moral versus immoral action or moral versus amoral action. You are going to be in a world of business people. They win when they cheat. They win when they lie. They win when they are unethical. The stories are all over the place, and I could spend an entire semester telling you one story after another. Many of them famous, some I saw myself. But I'm not going to do that. You should thank God I'm not going to do that. It's very uncomfortable. But I am going to share with you something, an actual true story, one true story, a huge true story that happened. You know what? It really, really bothers me. This happened before you were born, and it wasn't that long ago. God, I'm getting old. Okay. True story. The problem is that this story is told two different ways. And most of the people who have some knowledge of this, they have an agenda. Either they are on the side of the bad guys and they are liberal leftists, or they are on the side that supposedly is the good guys and they're neo-fascist right-wingers. So no matter how I talk, I'm going to have both sides hate my guts. So there you go. But I'm going to put you in the position. Let me see. You are on the verge of becoming $2 billion rich. This is a true story. $2 billion rich. No, you have nothing. You live in a hovel. You live in a double-wide trailer on the south side of Memphis, and you have to make extra income by doing Elvis impersonations for children's parties on the weekends. It came from hell. You have the chance to make $2 billion literally by saying four magic words. You forfeit the $2 billion by saying two other magic words. That's all you have to do is say four magic words, and you have $2 billion. You will be loved by many people. You will become a great philanthropist. You will give to social and charitable organizations, to schools where you will go and the children will sing your praises. You will walk into rooms and everyone will stand up and applaud you. You will be famous, and the few people who know what you did, who hate you, they're crazies. They're Alex Jones types, the nutcase conspiracy theorists, and far-right neo-fascists. But the real people know that you're a great man. You contribute to charities. You are just a wonderful person. You will live longer than almost anyone else because you have such great money. You could actually have a girlfriend. Right? I knew there was some way I could do it, but I just couldn't get the $2 million together. You would never want for anything at all. You want dinner in Paris? You have a private jet flies you to Paris. I kid you not, you are that wealthy. Anything you want, life, love, health, they are all there for many more years than most people live. You can even go to places that almost no one else knows about in Europe, where they can give you medicines that make you live longer and make you feel better well into your 80s, your 90s. And all you have to do is say four magic words. Just four. But there's a downside, and it really doesn't affect you. If you do this, you will literally wreck a nation. You will destroy its central bank, and the nation that was teetering on the verge of a recession will drop into a horrendous recession. Millions of people will be out of work. Families will break up. People will commit suicide. People will not have health care, and they will die early. There will even be whispers and fears and rumors of the return of the king. And by the king, I mean King Cholera. You ever seen children die from cholera? It's horrible. They have diarrhea until they dehydrate so much that they just make one last whimper and then die. That's how bad it got, that there was a fear of King Cholera coming back in this economy. The economy got so bad that right-wing government stepped in where a more liberal, more tolerant government had been. It got so bad that the parliament of the country was reshaped forever. The politics turned mean. And there was more of a meanness in the people than there had ever been. And even ever since then, that same ugliness is still there because of that, almost like adult children of abuse coming of age in the late 20th and early 21st century. But that really isn't your problem. The four magic words make you $2 billion richer. The two magic words that would forfeit that make you so that you never have that money. It will never happen again, an opportunity like that, ever. The four magic words go for the jugular. The two magic words, stand down. Your turn. Say your words. Which ones? No, there aren't. There are none. It comes down on that moment, that morning. There were no other factors. It was just, I become $2 billion richer or I forfeit that chance forever and ever. That's all it is. Call it. Call it.
Stand down.
What say you, ma'am?
Just Yes,
you don't get any third. There's not a door number three. Okay, by the way, I'm not looking for an answer. I want you to be honest with yourselves. It will define how you are as business people, but it will also define how you live your life as far as your wealth goes, as far as all that goes. Ma'am, call it.
Go for the jugular.
Okay, you. No, you know, wait, if that's my own country, the hell with that. That's good. Hey, no, doesn't matter. I mean, look, even if it's your own country, they're not going to know you're rich. They'll still love you even if they're starving, especially if you give them a candy bar. Go for the jugular. Sir, you, call.
Stand down.
Stand down. Stand down. Go ahead.
Go for the jugular.
This happened in the early 1990s. Let me explain. This actually happened just like that. Now, there was a setup that went into it. You had to stage what was going to happen. And the staging of what is going to happen had to do with the politics of the time and the world. You see, in the 1980s came the first attempt by Europe to create a united front. Not necessarily a one country, but to make the first steps toward that ultimate goal of having a single European nation that also included England, which is technically not Europe, but England was in this too, Great Britain, I should say. So one of the first steps would not be to have a common currency. It would be just to get the currency so that they move together. That would be a first step toward a unified currency. But just get the currencies so that they didn't go too far away from each other. You see, if one country's currency becomes very strong against another currency, then capital will flow towards the country that has a strong currency. And it will flow away from the currents of the countries that have the weaker currency. That's what happens with the United States. We have a very strong currency, and so capital flows toward us. But at the same time, that means that we also tend not to be able to export too much. We import a lot when we have a strong currency. Now, you understand that the price of a currency, the rental rate of a currency is the country's interest rates. Literally, and that's something that surprised me. Most people coming out of these economics classes don't know that interest rates are the currency's price. So when interest rates are high, the dollar is strong, and that means capital flows toward us. When interest rates are low, the dollar is weak, and capital flows away from us. When interest rates are strong, we import more than we export because other countries want to get our currency by selling us cheap stuff. When our currency is weak, we export more than we import. That's why China wanted its currency to be weak for years and years. That way, their exports to the United States would be super cheap here. And ultimately, when we gave them dollars for their exports to us, those capital flows came toward us because our interest rates and our dollar were strong. It takes a while for that to soak in, trust me. It doesn't happen right away. But this part is clear. That what the Europeans and the Great Britain joining with them did was they created what was called an ERM. That's an exchange rate mechanism. It's like an agreement that the currencies will stay within a band of value. In other words, let's say the Italian lira begins to get weak against the French franc. What would happen is all the countries would get together and they would start buying lira to strengthen it and use French francs to do it, which would weaken the franc, and then the two currencies would balance out. In other words, they'd step in shoulder to shoulder to protect the currency so that they stayed within this band of trading. So, for example, the Deutschmark might get a little strong against the pound sterling. So what the group of countries would do is they would just start buying pound sterling
demand goes up, value goes up. And that, at the same time, because the supply of Deutsche Marks was beginning to get big, buying those pound sterling, that price of the Deutsche Mark would go down. So the balance would come back into where they wanted it. So you had all of these countries in Europe, France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and some other ones. I believe Netherlands was in it. Spain was in it. And then, of course, you had Great Britain right across the channel. And they were all in this exchange rate mechanism, working with each other to keep their currencies behaving each other with each other in certain bands. Now, let's look at Germany and Great Britain. The band of values. Now, the pound sterling and the German Deutschmark bounced around their value. Sometimes the pound sterling got a little bit too high against the Deutschmark, and so there'd be intervention, or there'd be a go too low, and they'd push it back into the band. Everything was nice. Everyone played by the rules, and it was working. In other words, it wasn't a single euro currency, but it was the first step toward one. The currencies would still be each country's, but they would not deviate too far from each other's value under the exchange rate mechanism, the ERM. And then something wonderful and horrible happened. Soviet Union collapsed. In 1992-93, it just went to hell. This monster, this Cold War thing that had crawled across all of Eastern Europe, Russia, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the whole thing just died. And the worst part of it was, well, the coolest part was that Germany had been divided into two countries since the end of World War II. West Germany was on our side, East Germany was on the Soviet side, and the Berlin Wall was between them. And then, just one magnificent day, as the whole communist system fell apart and died, the people on the east side started tearing down the wall. And then the people on the west side, seeing their relatives on the other side tearing down the wall, everyone just started pulling down these massive blocks and cheering. There was music, there was smoke, there was pot, there was everything, booze, and everyone was celebrating. It was awesome. And then the West Germans got their first look at East Germany, their brother that had been separated them for all those decades. It was a wasteland. Electricity was hardly there. Sewerage was awful. Water, unclean water. Buildings in decay. Roads broken and sometimes not even there anymore, just dirt where there were roads all through East Germany. Well, West Germany, this is our country. We're going to rebuild you. We're going to unify. We are one country. You are us. We are going to fix this. And it was perhaps one of the biggest projects in the 20th century in some ways, repairing a country that had been completely ruined, wrecked, half of a country, I should say, by communism and its incompetence and its corruption and its lies and its propaganda instead of action. And so we had Germany, West Germany, just said, all right, we're going to rebuild it. Well, here's how you do it. West Germany had a very strong economy, a strong central bank, the Bundesbank. And what the Bundesbank did was we're just going to have to borrow as much as we need to rebuild the east side of this country. And they borrowed, and they borrowed. And, of course, as a country borrows more money, what happens to the interest rates in that country? As a country, they go up. Of course, the supply of funds, the supply of Deutsch-denominated debt was increasing, price goes down, yield goes up. They would pay whatever interest rate they needed to get the money to draw the capital. In other words, the Deutschmark just got stronger and stronger and stronger because the interest rates in Germany kept going up and up and up. Germany would pay whatever interest rate it needed. It was a strong country, so it could handle it. And they were going to rebuild East Germany. Well, unfortunately, what that meant was that the other countries in the exchange rate mechanism, if the Deutschmark goes up, then that's always a relative. Then all of the other currencies go down unless they raise their interest rates or do something. So what happened was that this band, the exchange rate mechanism, the worst hit was Great Britain. Because Great Britain was already teetering on the verge of a recession, they didn't really dare raise their interest rates, to try to strengthen their currency. They couldn't, because it would have made the recession worse. And so what was happening was the pound sterling was bouncing down here at the bottom. And in order to keep it from breaking through the bottom, Great Britain had to do something to strengthen its currency. What did it do? It started selling its gold reserves to buy its own pound sterling. In order to support the currency, it had to buy its own currency with its gold reserves. Every day, the pound is about to break through. Well, jolly good. Bring out some more gold, sell it. Buy our pound. In other words, you're selling your gold to save your ass. And you see there's a problem with that. Eventually you run out of gold and things like that. And it was just getting to the point where it was just ludicrous. The pound sterling wanted to break way through. It wanted to break. And because Great Britain, they're British, well, we honor our agreements. We're certainly not going to violate our agreements. And over here, the Germans are saying, well, we are. We're just going to keep driving interest rates up, making your currency weaker and weaker. And the only way you can keep within the ERM is to just keep using your gold to buy your currency, because none of the other countries could do it because they were already in trouble themselves. Their currencies were devaluing against the Deutschmark. No one could help anyone. But everyone knew what was going to happen. Sooner or later, Great Britain was going to run out of gold. It was just going to have to say, all right, that's it. We are out of the exchange rate mechanism. And of course, then the pound sterling would just collapse very hard, drop in value insanely. Enter a group of currency traders led by a man named George Soros. Yeah. George Soros was the spearhead. He had lackeys around him, and then he had other traders who were in other currency trading funds that were following his lead. So his logic was this: all right, Great Britain, you're still in the ERM. What we're going to do is borrow hundreds of millions of pounds sterling from your banks. We're going to borrow hundreds of millions in pound sterling. And what we're going to do is we're going to use those to buy that money to buy Deutschmarks. Okay? So that when the collapse happened, overnight, the Ministry of Finance said, that's it, we're out. We can't use any more gold. The pound sterling dropped through the floor. So these hundreds of millions of dollars in loans denominated in pound sterling became worth pennies on the dollar because the currency had collapsed. And the Deutschmark had skyrocketed on the collapse of the exchange rate mechanism. So all they had to do were take a few of these Deutschmarks they had previously bought, and pay off these loans that were now worth almost nothing. And so the asset list on the banks for loans that they had outstanding that were denominated at 150 million pounds sterling, they got absolutely nothing, or virtually nothing. The morning that the trade was going to be done to pay off the loans with the Deutschmark, Soros's lackey, head lackey, came in and said, "What do I do?" Soros looked him in the eye and said, "Go for the jugular." And they did. The Bank of England collapsed. Go for the jugular. Now, he could have said, "Stand down. Get me on the phone with the exchequer of the currency, of the treasury. We'll get a meeting together. We'll figure out how to fix this so your banks don't collapse. Yeah, we got these loans. Let's work out some kind of a reorg on the loans, and we'll make some money out of it. But, you know, we're not going to just completely destroy the economy. My God, that's horrible. Stand down." Instead, George Soros said, "Just go for the jugular. Take a few of those extremely expensive Deutschmarks, pay off all of those loans in pounds sterling to the banks in England, and those banks will have nothing on their balance sheets because those loans are now worth nothing. It's like you have an asset, you've lent $100 million in loans, and then when you get it back, the true value of the money you get back is, let's say, $1,000. In a day, Soros and his team made $3.5 billion, of which $2 billion was Soros got, and then the other traders around him and traders that jumped in as it was happening, they just fed the disaster as it collapsed over the morning. Another funny thing about it was, a hilarious thing, is that the finance ministry got together that afternoon, and the minister of finance, talking to the prime minister of Great Britain, said, we are going to have Interpol arrest George Soros. We are going to go after him. Why? Well, he's violated international law. And a great thing happened there. Someone said, there is no such thing as international law. There isn't. Then and now, there's no international law. There's the law of the winner. Oh, we took these guys from Serbia and took them to the International Court of The Hague. Yeah, that's because we won the war. There wasn't any international law being violated whatsoever. The Geneva Conventions and all that, yeah, we really showed how strong those are with what we did in Iran and Iraq, in Iraq and Afghanistan. No international law. Soros didn't break any laws. He could have kept this from happening, kept the economy from completely going to hell because the central bank had gone to hell. But instead, he said, go for the jugular. He became very insanely wealthy. He didn't have to, but he did. So that sets the backdrop for what is and what is not right. But in the end, it actually kind of doesn't matter. As you can see, it didn't in that case. Look. I can set up a matrix like this. Legal and illegal on the rows, right and wrong on the columns. In other words, we could divide actions legal and right, illegal and right, legal and wrong, illegal and wrong. But it's not abstract. I'm not talking about the big, huge wrongs like Citibank and Bank of America and all those kinds of nasties. I'm talking about your day-to-day business. Let's start with a couple of basics. Well, let's try something a little close. Who's a marketing major here? Okay, good. Okay, tell me about consumer choice architecture. You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? Got nothing, right? You know what it is? Consumer choice architecture? Every one of you, every day, faces it. It is one of the hottest, most important parts of business. Consumer choice architecture is merely creating the conditions where you think you are choosing by free will, but you are actually choosing what they want you to choose. It can be as simple as yes, no on a screen. The yes is a green button. The no is an almost imperceptibly smaller red button. Yes, just reactive to that. Give me a minute here. Another example of consumer choice architecture. You can buy our less pricey shampoo, or, madam, you can buy the luxurious brand. It's thick. It's rich. Your hair will float back and forth, and you will move in slow motion. People will like you more if you buy the expensive product, but we can offer you the cheap product if that's what you really want. You know darn well more people are going to do that. Go ahead. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Did you know that many of the major grocery store chains have increased the size of their shopping carts in recent years? We found out that you double the size of a shopping cart and consumers will buy 19% more in terms of purchases. Well, of course. Or the, and matter of fact, you go into the Walmart. I live at Walmart. I admit it. You walk into the aisles, and there's the candy for the kids to scream about having. There are all the salacious magazines. Read this magazine so that you can be fertile. Or and the cooking magazines. Yes, look at this delicious dessert that you can make. Now, of course, when you make it, it'll look like crap. But they just shape you every day, every way. I got the form to sign up for my organization. And it's interesting because it has two yeses. Yes, I want to join and I want to buy one of your logo t-shirts as well. Yes, I want to join, but I don't want the t-shirt. The yes, I want to join and buy the t-shirt is takes up two-thirds of the space. I shouldn't do that. I mean, is that right or wrong? Talk to me. What? No? Yes?
I'm going to tell you, you walk your entire day manipulating someone somehow.
Me? I don't manipulate anyone. Look at me. By the way, I'm available tonight for consulting. No. You see, there's the problem, is that when is it, does it cross a line? Oh, well, you see, here's the problem. It's right and wrong. That's really not every situation. You can't just say right or wrong. And you're thinking to me, why are you trying to break it down into right or wrong, fat boy? Well, because originally in philosophical analysis, that was how it was done. There was a philosopher about 300 years ago named Immanuel Kant. He laid out what was called the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative says your action should be what you would expect any other person's action to be at all times, in all situations. Again, your action should be what you would expect of anyone else and everyone else. Yeah. That's not what Immanuel Kant said. That's not what he said.
I'd argue that you never lie, ever, under any circumstances, that you would bring the whole world to madness.
It doesn't matter. Kant said categorical. Categorical. Now, this sounds like the golden rule. It's not, because this doesn't have anything to do with you in most situations. You are just going to act the way you would expect anyone else to act in a situation, you will not deviate. In other words, you have a core of convictions. Your code of conduct exactly references, at all times goes right to the core of convictions and says, what's the act, how do I proceed? There is not a shifting around. It is always going to that core of convictions. Now, going to your point, by the 19th century, you had situational ethics beginning to play. Oh, the Kant, I mean, you can't do that. So you had several different variations on the situational ethics. And this was the most famous one, the one that you probably would know the most about, because it's how we proceed as a nation and in a lot of situations. This is called utilitarianism. Now, utilitarianism, breaking it down kind of a little bit simplistically, says you do in any situation what is good for the most people. Do what is best, do what is good for the most people. And that has been a guiding principle of democracies and even many monarchies and other forms of government, is we can't do right by everyone. That's just impossible. But we can do what is best for the most people in any given situation. However, that does not mean that this is a wonderful philosophy. It's not. Think about this. Let me play this one out. Try this. You, ma'am, are in charge of supervision of a life-saving drug for a type of children's cancer. Now, most children who get this cancer live about 2 years, and then they die. But your drug actually cures the cancer. You are going to make the announcement tomorrow morning. Because the trials, clinical trials, have established it. The FDA is going to go with it. And, of course, Wall Street has already been pushing the price of the stock up in expectation of this good news. They had insider information, all that. So there's a lab assistant. You're in your office. It's about 7:30. Everyone's gone home, and you're there by yourself, but a lab assistant comes in. You don't see the data, do you? This drug, actually, out of every 100 kids we've administered to it, it cures the disease. But in an average of 2 kids in every round of the study, they died within a week. They would have lived 2 years, but they die within a week. Just 2 kids out of 100. 98, their lives are finished. Their lives are fixed. They're okay. Tomorrow morning, the cameras are waiting. What do you do? Now, you remember what's going to happen if you tell the truth. The Wall Street boys are going to drive that stock through the ground. They're going to drill it down so it hears Chinese voices. And then you are going to have your ass fired. And they're going to blame you for manipulating the studies. You might even go to prison for lying, like all big companies like to try to do to people. What are you going to do? But remember, you're also saving 98 kids who would die. What do you do? Don't say I feel. Never say I feel. On one of my tests, warning, don't ever say I feel. I will take off half your points. There are no feelings. We're business people, for God's sake. Say it. What are you going to do?
I would tell the truth.
Oh. Say goodbye to this nice lady. What would you do? Imagine you're a father. Would you want a drug that would save your kid from cancer?
Come on.
Okay, great. Okay. You've done it. What would you do?
Talk. I'd release it.
You release it. What happens if one of the two kids was your kid? No chance. He dies.
Yeah, but he took the drugs, at least he had a chance.
So he had a 98% chance of living, but a 2% chance. And if he's one of the two that dies?
Living 100%. Okay.
You see the problem here, though, that situational ethics can bite you in the ass. Because no matter how you play it, there will be losers. Maybe the greatest number of people will do better, but there will be losers in a situational ethic framework. Now, the matrix here, right and legal, Right and legal. Well, that's, well, you know, right and legal, I adopt stray cats. Yeah, that's right and legal. Okay, so kind of a lame example. Right and illegal. There is a person now in prison who was working for the Department of Defense, and she downloaded a group of files. One of those files was a gun camera showing one of our gunships laying waste to a group of people that there were two armed people, so the gun crew figured that it had to be bad guys. Turned out it was a bunch of journalists, Western journalists, and their two security guards just slaughtered them. And they told a lie to everyone that it was some combat mistake, a combat attack by insurgents in Iraq. And when she released it, it was obvious we had done the killing ourselves and then lied about it. She went to prison, right and illegal, because she released secret information. Legal and wrong, George Soros. Maybe, maybe not, but it was legal. Illegal and wrong, well, that's pretty easy to call. There are a whole bunch of things, and I won't even bring them up because some of the things, illegal and wrong. I won't even bring it up. But, okay, now, let me take you to the next part of this. And in order to do what I'm about to do, I have to explain, first of all, a little bit of legal terminology. One thing is important. When I say the word person, in law, that doesn't necessarily mean a human being. A person is a legal entity. It could be a single individual, but in law, a person could be a group bound under contract. It could be a partnership. A marriage is a person. The stockholders as a whole are a person. The corporation is a person under the law. So you understand that person has a broader meaning. The problem was that the Supreme Court, and I think it's probably been about 10 years ago, they took that so far that they declared that corporations have the constitutional rights of people, of humans. That was in Citizens United case. They've been moving in that direction for many years toward giving more constitutional recognition to things that aren't humans, not actual citizens. And there's no way to reel it back now, hence why we can have corporations make massive contributions to political campaigns now. Because under the Constitution, free speech gives people the right to do what they want that way, free assembly. And so we have this era we're in now where it's just, there's no way normal people can contribute as much as corporations and coalitions of corporations can. So the word person, try not to take it too far like the Supreme Court did, but a person can be more than just an individual. Look, we'll start with a story. You like stories. I know you do. I've seen you you listen to my stories, rolling your eyes at how boring they are. So here's what I'm going to do. Sir, you are driving on one of these nice, straight, smooth country roads. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining clear. You can see right way out in front of you. You drive past a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit sign. Yeah, and of course, when you see 55 miles per hour, you think, hold my beer. Yeah, it's a challenge, a suggestion. You know, if you're a wuss, 55 miles an hour. Well, you decide that you are going to, well, obviously, you're going to hit the accelerator. You know, the speed limit, your speedometer goes up. Your RPMs begin to go into scientific notation. And, you know, you see stars starting to streak by you. You hear a voice, warp 6, Mr. Sulu. You're driving like a blind trout down the road. Way, way up the road, one of those spurs into one of the fields, you notice there's a car in it. Some farmer. As you get a little closer, you realize it's the sheriff's deputy car. Uh-oh. So what do you do?
Of
going to slow down, aren't you? Yeah, slow down. You get closer and closer, and you realize, oh, God, he's outside the car. He's using one of those radar guns. Then you realize he's stooped over. He's changing the tire. Well, of course, that means you're going to just push that pedal right back down. You'll wave at him, hi, officer. Yeah. You see, monitoring is the first part of enforcement. A contract means nothing if it cannot be monitored. And enforcement is the second part. A contract means nothing if it can't be enforced. You have to have both. You can monitor, but if you can't enforce, you have nothing. You can enforce, but if you can't monitor, you've got nothing. You must have monitoring and enforcement. Hence, we come to the agency dilemma. Which is one of the most important things that I will teach you. You're going to be managers, almost all of you, God help us. But you are going to be the boss someday. And this is the reality of the management dilemma. It's called the agency dilemma. A person called the agent who is responsible for maximizing the welfare of another person called the principal, and that's with AL, has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead. That's the agency dilemma. The agent has incentive to help itself instead of whom it's supposed to help. Think about it this way. Okay, first of all, let's get agent and principal down here. The shareholders are the principal. The directors and the executive officers are the agents. Their job is to maximize the value of the stock of the shareholders. That's their job. That's their only job. Another example would be, for example, a doctor and a patient. The doctor is the agent maximizing the welfare of the patient, the principal. Let's try another one here. Let's try a couple more. Parent and child. Parent and child. Who is the agent and who's the principal in a parent-child relationship? Absolutely, the parent is the agent because it's the parent's duty to maximize the welfare of the child. The child is the principal, interestingly enough. Let's try this one. Here's an interesting one. In a marriage, who is the agent and who is the principal? And do be cautious. It'll take a few minutes for an ambulance to get here if you say the wrong thing. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a marriage? The agent is the husband? Good answer. Wrong, but good. You will live to eat cupcakes tonight. Who's the agent and who's the principal in a parent-child relationship? In a marriage. Actually, neither. The husband and the wife are both the agents. The marriage is the principal. It doesn't even have a life, but it is the marriage. The marriage is both the man and the woman are charged with maximizing the welfare of the marriage itself. The marriage doesn't have to be a living thing. Remember, it's a person under the law, and that is what you're supposed to be maximizing, is the welfare of that person. So both of them are the agents of the marriage, and the marriage is the principle. In the same way that, for example, I, as a soldier, you take an oath. I obviously, the soldier is the agent. Who's the principal in that one? Let me tell you what the oath says. I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The Constitution is the principle. It is a lifeless document brought to life only by the defense of it, by its agents, the soldiers. It's kind of interesting that way. Now, let's try something here. Agent and principal. You, sir, have become married. Okay, you've been happily married for, let's say, 3 or 4 years. 4 years, okay? Now, you and your wife are very happy. And one night, your wife is out of town, and you get a call. Hi, remember us? We were from the sorority. We're having a bong and pong. And we'd love to have you here because later we need a judge for a twerkathon. What are you going to do?
I guess I gotta go.
You gotta go. The hell with that marriage. Uh-huh.
Gotta judge.
Yeah, and don't judge me. You see what's happening there? He has an incentive to break the hurt it, to harm it, to do what is not in its interest. That is the reality of it. You will have employees. They will have the incentive. They will have an incentive to steal, to lie, to do all those things. You see, the problem is that it is not their fault. It is the management's responsibility. The principal is in charge of monitoring and enforcement. But the reality is, let me tell you about being a parent. You are dog tired. You are just worn out. You've had a whole long day, and you're staggering in. And the kids are just out of control. They're bouncing off the walls. One of them is jumping up and down on the couch. They're writing on the ceiling. They're just going crazy. Now, what you should do, you are the principal. You're supposed to run up to the kids. Just, come on, sweeties. Come on, let's not do that. Come on, let's make a nutritious meal. Daddy and mommy will make you. Well, mommy's not here because mommy runs around too much. Oh, she's working, and I'm here. I love you so much. I'm going to make you a nutritious meal, and then we're going to take bathies, and then I'm going to read you bookies and tuck you in. I love you so much. You know what you're really going to do? You stagger and you see the kids going crazy, bouncing around, swinging on the land. There's one jumping on the couch. Yeah. You, knock it off. God, oh, look at all you. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself. You're bad. And you're ugly, too. That's not my fault. That's what you're going to do. Nuke and puke. Not a nutritious meal. Nuke and puke. Not a nice bookie to read. Watch whatever's on Netflix that you can get without being 18. Play some games. Learn how to kill people in Call of Duty. Yeah, that's the reality of it. You see, the problem is that you have an incentive not to do what you're supposed to when you're the agent. That's just how it works. Now, in management and in business, we have to, I said this early on, whenever you have something that is a cost, we need to liquidate it. In other words, make a value of it. So that we can talk about controlling it. Sometimes there's a cost that an agency costs that's just not worth stopping. Someone's stealing paper clips. Okay, fine. Let's put up a giant monitoring system, have security guards and all that. No. You have to ask for the balance. How far do you go in monitoring and enforcement? But remember, it is management's job. It is the principal's job, not the agent. Now, breaking down those different costs that can occur, there are 5 agency costs. Agency costs. The first one is perquisites, or perks. Perquisites are benefits arising by position. The executive that has the desk that is so big it looks like a landing zone on an aircraft carrier. The out-of-town trips that have five-star hotels, perks. The private jet that takes you to a meeting in another state. That is shareholder money. Oh, we have to do it this way. Yeah, that's an expense. Meals and entertainment, that's you. More than a few years back, I was at a nice dinner, and there were a couple of these executives. We've got a position open for a comptroller. You should take it instead of being paid this lousy amount you are as a professor. I said, you don't want me. First of all, that jet that takes you places, Greyhound goes to almost every city. Fancy meals at five-star restaurants, no. McDonald's is 24/7, and those nice fancy hotels, really? I can tell you where there are hotels in a lot of cities, and they're great, and they have that quarter machine that makes it even better. Went right over the crowd. The hell with that. Okay. The next one is shirking, avoiding duties. Avoiding duties. This is the person who's, instead of being in his or her cubicle, wanders around talking to people. I saw an incredible example of this in a company I consulted for many years back. After about a week, I noticed that there was this one account executive. Every morning, he came in like clockwork, right on the dot at 8 o'clock. He walked right by the receptionist's desk, grabbed the Wall Street Journal off the desk, and went in and sat in the men's toilet for 40 minutes, exactly 40 minutes every day. That man was so regular, I want to know what root vegetables he ate. Shirking. Another executive, amazing. Same consulting gig, interestingly. He loved to brag at dinners we had. My desk is clean every night. I make sure that I've taken care of everything every night. I sleep well that way. Well, you know what he did? He got tons of work on his desk every night. He'd just walk around and put it on his subordinates' desks to do. That was how he did it. Yeah, good man. Shirking. Another one, direct theft, just stealing, just out stealing. It constitutes billions of dollars every year. And it's like you hear, well, it's these dirty, low-level employees that steal. Well, no, it's everyone. We all do it. Does it get out of hand sometimes? Oh, yeah, there are many. I mean, wonderful examples some years back at one of those places that have the lines for a frozen yogurt. People standing in a long line. It was very popular and, you know, waiting their turn. And there were some people who'd figure out what they owed, and they'd have the direct change, the exact change. And so they'd go up, and the guy taking the money, as soon as it was direct change, he would just put it on the counter and say, next. Of course, those people were glad they didn't have to wait for a receipt. The people behind were glad because they got up. And every now and then, you'd see him just leaning forward, looking at the crowd, and he'd be sweeping the money from the ledge of the cash register into his apron, like that. Theft. That was a beautiful one. Lying. Lying. Yeah, I didn't come in today because I was sick. I didn't get that project done because he didn't get his part of it done. Now, understand there are actually two versions of lying. One is you're just lying because you're lazy. The other is when you've got a manager who's got essentially a cluster B personality disorder. They're very big. They're very common in business. They're very, because they get promoted a lot. But they put people in positions where they feel like they have to lie. You got deadlines that are too short on people, or they find the manager pushes them so hard and asks them ridiculous things, and if they feel compelled to lie to protect themselves, you got to watch out for that. If they're lying because they're afraid of you, they're not the ones who have the problem. You're the man, or afraid of some manager. You always keep an eye on those low-level managers to make sure they're not narcissistic personality disorders feeding their own egos by making their employees lie, and then they catch them in the lies. Okay, now the last one. Have you ever met someone, have you ever worked, Have you ever worked any place where one or more of your co-employees was stupid as a box of rocks, and that was disrespecting rocks by saying that? You are the stupidest. My God, you are so stupid that if there was a... let's not go. Incompetence. But I caution you, because incompetence is a fundamental part of business. Some years back, there was a management expert who laid it out. His name was Dr. Peter, and he described what came to be known as the Peter Principle. And there was a book about it. And a lot of people thought it was just some, ha-ha, this is hilarious. He was dead serious, and it is now accepted. The Peter Principle simply says that everyone in a business is either at or on the road to incompetence. Think about it this way. Do I have a finance major here? A finance major? Okay, good. You, sir. You have been hired by this company. Finance, low level. You do an incredible job. You're an animal with Excel spreadsheets. You're great. But yeah, so obviously we promote you, put a few people under you. You're still great. You keep getting better and better. I mean, it's just there's a little darkness in you because you know that every time you get a promotion, you're coming closer to where you're having a hard time doing this. But you just keep getting advanced, and finally you are at the level of the junior financial officer. One day, the music in your office stops playing. And suddenly, this sound. Ba, 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 ba. Oh my God, it's the chief executive officer of the company. And he's walking right toward you. You have become famous here. My chief financial officer just left. He seemed to have something in his throat. I want you to become the chief financial officer of this company. Now, you know very well, you can't do that job. But here I am. I am your father. Together, we can rule the galaxy. Join me or die. Oh, by the way, you also get the keys to the washroom. Your own private car. $1 million of salary, all of that, if you will join me. You can't do the job. What are you going to say? What are you going to do? You're not. Will you take the job? You can't even do it either, but you're going to take it. Someone's going to take that job. You understand? That's a Peter Principle. That is where we are at the end of this. And now there's a PowerPoint online. That's all I have for you. I thank you.